Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. What I'm about to tell you sounds like a movie plot, perhaps a psychological thriller, but it's a true story about how our life circumstances can really impact our health. In 1975, Bob Delaney was a New Jersey state trooper. He was 22 years old and about to go on a really dangerous mission, codenamed Project Alpha. He became an undercover agent to infiltrate the mob, the Bruno and Genovese crime family specifically.
You know, the enthusiasm of youth and going after bad guys.
Delaney had no idea what he was in for. He was given a new identity, Bobby Covert. That's kind of ironic. And as a cover story, the FBI set him up as the boss of a trucking company to do business with the mob.
My whole persona changed. I became Bobby Covert. I wasn't playing Bobby Covert.
He stayed undercover for 3 years, getting closer and closer with his mob connections. They would go out to dinner, they would have drinks, and the whole time, Bobby Covert is wearing a wire.
This reel-to-reel recorder was placed on my body, hidden. Wires were up underneath my armpits. And while I'm having these conversations, I know I'm wearing that wire. Obviously, they don't. But if I get caught with that wire, I know in that world, informants die. So that's the constant fear that I lived in.
He was able to hide that fear while they were all hanging out.
But I'd get 2 miles down the street after meeting with the mob guys, and I'd have to pull over and throw up. Or I'd have to get to the first gas station I could find because I had diarrhea. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd be soaking wet.
Delaney was the enemy within, embedded in a dangerous group of people who thought he was their friend. And in the end, his role helped unravel this complex crime syndicate. The stress of that caught up with him big time, though, after his mission ended in success. He returned to regular police work, but he wasn't the same. For years, he had severe PTSD, and that became the enemy within him.
I had hypervigilance. I'd walk around in the middle of the night with my gun drawn, pulling back shower curtains, looking behind doors, thinking they were coming to get me. Isolation and avoidance. I didn't want to be around anyone. I had tremendous thirst for revenge, and I also had a tremendous quick anger fits that would show themselves in so many ways.
It took a lot of time to fight that enemy and to become whole again. It meant a career change. He became a professional NBA referee.
See this. Wow! Bob Delaney calling a 10-second violation as Dwight Howard gets the ball waiting for the...
Delaney also got help. He was in therapy, but still, that enemy within rears its head from time to time. And if you think about it, most of us have some kind of struggle within that we're facing every day. And that is what our show is about today. The enemy within, how we manage it, fight it, or come to terms with it. Our first story is a look at what happens when your own body becomes your enemy. Millions of Americans live with a chronic illness. It might not be life-threatening, but it is disrupting their lives in major ways. It's causing them pain, keeping them from activities they love. And with some of these chronic illnesses, like arthritis or lupus or MS, you can just barely manage the symptoms. A cure is not yet available. So there's an adjustment that has to happen. And our Pulse reporter, Tanya English, has been looking into just how people make this adjustment. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Maiken. You know, it's a fascinating topic. I mean, what do people do when they have a body that is not going to get better? So I went out and reported and spoke with three different women who are kind of dealing with that. How do people make peace when they have an illness that feels like an enemy within? The first person that I spoke with is Molly Dennis. She's 29, and ever since puberty, she's been feeling just a little bit unwell, and she's tired all the time.
More often than not, my physicians would say, well, I think maybe you're depressed, or, you know, maybe you just need to get a better night's sleep, things like that, and it was never taken seriously.
That might have been because Molly was very young when her symptoms first started, and it just seemed like the doctors didn't seem to really hear her when she complained. And then a decade went by, she was still exhausted, still sucking it up, and living with freezing cold feet and a lot of pain. And then finally, after switching to a new doctor, Molly learned that she has lupus. Lupus is an illness where the immune system gets confused and it starts attacking different parts of the body.
I always joke that my body just hates itself.
Molly has a sense of humor about all of this, and there is good treatment to keep her disease in check. But she says it's really frustrating knowing that she's never going to be well again.
Not only is it not going to go away, you have no way of predicting how it's going to affect you. So I might be feeling great today, but in 2 weeks, I could be in the hospital. I'm a planner. I want to know what's happening. And this is something that will not let me do that.
Molly was diagnosed 5 years ago. And she remembers that that first year after her diagnosis, she cycled through many different feelings. You know, there was denial at first, and then some anger, and then depression. And then now, 5 years later, she's found kind of a wavering acceptance.
I am doing very well. Don't get me wrong. If you asked my doctor, he would tell you that I'm in remission. I don't know how I feel about that terminology, though. I always feel like I have lupus. Do you know what I mean? Like, I always feel the effects. You know, I always have those days where I can't keep my eyes open.
So is she able to work?
Yeah. So lupus, there's a spectrum of illness, and she's a little bit on the milder side. And so she does work. She works as a social worker, and she's also on some medicine now that's eased her pain. She found a support group that's helped her out a lot. And a few years ago, she decided to transform herself into a runner.
I had a partner at the time, and I remember looking at him being like, I'm going to start running. You know, it's like, okay. And I did.
And that's how she copes. And this fall, she ran her fifth 5K race for charity.
Does running lift her mood, or what does it do for her?
Yeah, Molly says even when she's not feeling well, when she's running, she's never felt so accomplished.
You said Molly has a milder version or case of lupus, and I'm assuming that running is not an option for a lot of people who are dealing with serious chronic illness. So what else did you find? What else do people do?
Yeah, so everyone kind of deals with it differently. The next person that I spoke with was Emily Cease. She has fibromyalgia. That's a condition that comes from chronic sleep problems. As a result, Emily has all over muscle pain and tenderness, and even just sitting for too long or putting on a bra sends pain messages to her brain. To diagnose the condition, her doctor did kind of a classic simple test.
He touched points on like the upper back, around my neck, around my elbows and knees, and he sent shockwaves of pain through my body with that, you know, to the point where my knees buckled at one point.
Mike, and you can even hear Emily's struggle in her voice. It's a bit shaky, and she says unsteady is how she feels all the time.
So what does she do?
Emily lives in central Illinois with her husband, and she has a dog and a cat and a circle of friends that are supportive for her, but she says maybe it's her online community that really helps the most.
These people are my friends. I call them my internet BFFs.
On Twitter and on her blog, Emily connects with people who are also dealing with an illness that is not going to go away. They post funny videos and they create GIFs, and they find each other with the hashtag chronic life or hashtag chronic pain. On the internet, Emily says she doesn't have to keep up appearances.
You kind of need to talk to somebody who just gets it. It's a way to kind of give my caregiver, my husband, a break from having to listen to me all the time. Because it's every day, it's all day, it never stops.
Emily says that social media is a place where she can let her guard down and just be herself. And also her Twitter friends have given her a boldness that she says she never had before. She was raised to respect and defer to authority, and that includes doctors.
Dealing with this illness, I've kind of had to relearn everything. And, you know, when I'm in some situations, I almost feel like I have to be combative to get my point across or to get the treatment or care I need.
A few weeks ago, for the first time, Emily admitted to herself, and she announced on her blog, that having a debilitating illness is her new normal.
Up until that point, I had kind of seen myself as this healthy person just waiting for her luck to change, you know? Like, one day this is all just going to be over and I won't have to deal with it anymore.
And Tanya, it seems like a lot of people have to reach that moment. And that sounds like a really hard, hard moment.
Yeah, the third person that I spoke with, her name is Cherie Perrone. She has lupus. And that moment came for her, that realization came for her maybe 10 years ago at the end of a day of work. She was walking to her car and suddenly she got confused. So she called her husband.
And he said, where are you? I said, I'm at work. I'm in the park. What do you mean you can't get home? I said, I don't remember how to get home. I just don't remember.
So she didn't know where she was?
Yeah. So a lot of people don't know this, but memory loss or lapses in memory called lupus fog can come with lupus sometimes. Cherie also has some more of the classic symptoms. She has a lot of fatigue and pain, and she's dealing with swollen hands all the time.
I'm in pain every day. I guess at my worst, my hands really look like baseball mitts.
Her pain and her memory lapses have been socially isolating for Cherie, but she says she gets comfort from volunteering, and that's the way she copes. Her activism is on display all the time.
Somebody will say, didn't I see you in purple yesterday? Yes. You wear purple every day? Yes. Why do you wear purple? Because I have lupus.
Like pink for breast cancer, purple is the awareness color for lupus. The day that we met, Cherie had on plum corduroy pants. She had boysenberry suede shoes and purple bracelets.
I have on my purple lupus band that says, help us solve the cruel mystery. My wedding ring has a purple stone in it.
Cherie doesn't work anymore. She's officially disabled today. But a couple times a week, she volunteers for the Lupus Foundation of America. It's a struggle for her just to walk the 75 feet from the parking lot to the office building.
That's my journey. I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm a little winded. Still achy.
After a few quiet moments to recover and a sip of her tea, Cherie spent the afternoon on the phone taking calls and speaking with other people newly diagnosed with lupus.
I have to live out what I'm telling other people. And I can't sit there and say it's going to be okay if I don't believe that's going to be the case.
I guess she tries to talk people through dealing with their lives and finding a way forward. But what is science saying to all of this? What do we know about lupus?
Lupus is an autoimmune disease, and that's kind of an umbrella term for maybe 24 different kinds of illnesses. And as a group, autoimmune diseases are more common today than they were maybe a decade ago. They include a lot of illnesses that you've probably heard before, so multiple sclerosis, celiac disease, scleroderma, and about 80% of the Americans who have an autoimmune disease are women.
These different diseases sound really different, though, and they all have totally different symptoms. So what do they have in common?
It's like a case of mistaken identity inside the body. The immune system starts to do battle with its own cells or tissues as if they were foreign invaders. With alopecia, it's the hair follicles. With celiac disease, the lining of the intestines is under attack. In the case of rheumatoid arthritis, the body thinks the joints are an enemy.
What do we know about the causes of autoimmune diseases and why are we seeing this rise?
I spoke with a physician from the American College of Rheumatology. She says that the increase in cases is probably not just because of better diagnosis or because of better awareness. A combination of genes and environment cause an autoimmune disease. And there's only a very short list of triggers that we've linked to these illnesses. The sun, smoking, some kinds of dust, certain kinds of radiation, and pesticides. And those are triggers, not causes. It's a little different.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today, we're talking about the enemy within our bodies, within our minds, within our families. And in the case of people suffering from addiction, it's all of the above. With the opioid crisis claiming more lives every day, communities are looking for new treatment options. There's a popular saying that many people in recovery use, that you have to change people, places, and things. And one new treatment model takes that place part to a bit of an extreme. Here's reporter Karen Brown boarding a small boat to an island off the coast of Cape Cod.
We leave the dock in Woods Hole on a 35-foot lobster boat and push off into the calm waters of Buzzards Bay. An overcast dawn has made way for blue skies and stunning visibility.
Seals out there on those rocks.
It's my first time on this hour-long trip, but for the staff of Penikese Island Treatment Program, this is their commute. Clinical Director Coco Wellington, a rugged, straight-talking woman, says it never gets old.
That's the island. I'm in love with that island. It's so starkly beautiful.
Once we're into the dock, you guys can step off and I'll get the rest.
As we pull in, three young men walk down a hill from an 1840s style farmhouse to help bring up groceries and prescription medicine from the mainland.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Coco.
Hi, good. How are you?
Doing excellent. How are you?
I'm well. Did you get your razor?
Yes,
I did.
Not long ago, these men were in jail, and before that, using or selling heroin. All three asked to be identified by first name only, Kevin, Tracy, and Brett. None of them have been here longer than a week.
How'd you guys sleep last night?
Like I was in hibernation.
As we walk up the hill, a few small buildings and wood piles dot the landscape, but mostly it's barren grassland with sandy inlets and wind-swept shrubbery. We walk into the main house to put away the food shipment.
What else needs to be done next?
You just want to throw one of the halves and one of the milks in the fridge. Yeah.
The 75-acre island was home to the Wampanoag Indians until the English arrived. A few centuries later, it housed a marine laboratory. In the early 1900s, the state of Massachusetts bought Penikese for a leper colony, its isolation ideal to hide away that era's medical pariahs. Oceanographer Jim Newman has long helped manage the island.
When the leper colony closed, they burned all the buildings. Not clear that anybody wanted it for a while there.
The island stood virtually empty until the 1970s, when a former Marine opened a school and boot camp for troubled boys. But after 40 years, enrollment declined and the school closed. That was 2011, just as the opioid epidemic in New England was taking hold. The board that oversees Penikese looked for an agency to turn it into an addiction treatment program for young men. And in August of this year, an organization called the Children's Study Home brought their first patient to the island.
A backgammon is if he gets one of his guys off before I get in my home.
Penikese is billed as a recreation of 19th century life. The only electricity is solar powered, just enough for the staff to charge their phones, run the fridge, and keep one laptop functional. There is Wi-Fi and a landline, but no TV, no iPods, no electric light.
So if I get a one, I can get you out.
Tracy is a 24-year-old New York City native who used to go to clubs every night. Now he passes the morning learning how to play backgammon from the nurse.
Number one.
Yep.
Put myself there, right?
Yep. Okay, double ones. Yeehaw.
The men went through detox before coming to the island. This is the therapeutic stage. They've been screened for suicidal and violent histories. The treatment philosophy revolves around delayed gratification. Any delivery is a day away. And the island itself is a therapeutic partner.
Penikese Island has one attribute that very few other places have, and that is isolation.
Weston Lant is island caretaker, a former rock band roadie turned organic farmer. He says the addiction program here is unlike even the best urban clinic, where in a moment of weakness,
you could walk out the door and drop a dime and get what you need, or what you think you need. Here, that's off the table, and that's as much a security issue as it is security for them. It's freedom. It's like, you don't have to think about it. It's not going to happen here. So now you get to think about everything else. Now you can focus.
But these men didn't exactly seek out the place for its therapeutic qualities. All had been convicted on drug charges and given the choice of incarceration or treatment.
It was like, this place got me in quicker. It was like, you can go here in 2 days or you can wait in jail for another month and a half, 2 months to get somewhere else.
20-year-old Kevin is the quietest of the three patients. For part of the day, he sits alone on the front porch, looking out at the bay and sometimes at his own feet. He's still adjusting.
So I came from jail, so I mean, everything's like loud and everyone's just crazy. And then you come here and it's just like dead silent all the time.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, it's just shocking. More time to like think. You just sit there thinking.
Holy God, what is that flying around up there? Is that a hornet's nest? There's too many of them flying around up there.
Brett is 26. He's already tried and failed at a more institutional rehab. He says he's open to the island's healing properties, but still getting used to kerosene lanterns, going to bed at 9, cooking on a cast iron stove.
You know, you gotta heat the stove by burning the wood multiple hours before you're trying to cook.
Not only that, but they have to chop the wood themselves.
You want to be back far enough from your cutting surface so that...
This is their first day of training on using an axe.
You want to eat? You got to cut wood.
Looks like I'm going to starve.
There you go.
Look at that. First crack.
Yeah.
This is also part of the treatment curriculum, physical exertion with a meditative undercurrent.
natural mindfulness. If you're not paying attention, you're going to cut your leg off.
Never really known what it meant, though. Mindfulness.
The confinement is more in your mind.
Staff member Weston Lant.
In other words, you're not in a rehab center. You're on an island, and you're not locked away while everybody else is conducting their life. You're conducting your life here.
There's room on the island for 12 patients, but the agency hasn't been able to hire enough staff for a full house. It's been hard to find and keep people willing to commute an hour by powerboat and leave their home for three-day shifts. The remaining therapists work to create a sense of family with the patients, the kind born of mutual dependency.
There's some rolls, you can pull out some bread.
Everyone cooks, eats, and cleans together. And as they do, therapy happens incidentally. Tracy hovers over a charcoal grill, having just finished a Skype meeting upstairs with an off-site psychiatrist.
He did. He's like, you got PTSD. I'm like, I do.
How'd it go?
Made me feel like I was crazy.
As the burgers cook, he tells counselor Nick Belomo that the doctor wants him to go on a new psychiatric medication.
You said do some research on him?
I mean, that would be my suggestion.
But how can you do that much if you think about it when you can't?
Google is amazing for a lot of things.
Okay, well, we're on an island where we cannot have electronics.
That seems like a fair point, though Belomo offers to print the information on his day off. Tracy shrugs and asks Brett to take over the grill.
I just burnt all the hair off my knuckles.
I really grab him.
Grab me a pair of tongs.
Judging from the good moods and mild weather, this seems like an ideal day on the island. But as the days get shorter, Brett expects life will get harder.
Well, it's going to get cold here real soon, and the winters aren't very fun on Cape, so can't imagine being on an island that's not very big. You know, snow, the wind, there's nothing to block any of the wind out.
And at one point, Brett whispers into my microphone the audio equivalent of a message in a bottle.
Take me back.
Help.
He's joking, of course, or half joking, but ultimately Wellington, the clinical director, says how the men react to the island's challenges over time will let staff know when they're ready to leave. It could be 30 days, 90 days, or longer.
Are they going to turn to staff and ask for help? That tells you something. Or are they just going to dissolve into a bundle, you know? Or are they going to run away? All of those things tell us how they manage stress.
The last official activity of the day is group therapy in the island's one-room schoolhouse. Wellington starts the session with a Tibetan bowl ringing and moves into a mindfulness exercise with M&Ms.
I want you to put it in your mouth, but do not chew it. Just feel it with your tongue. Feel the taste, the texture.
She then leads them into talking about addiction.
Right, what are the triggers? What are the triggers, and how do you react to them?
I don't know. I get what you're saying, where it could be like a buildup, though, because sometimes, like...
And then it's their turn to weigh in on the rules of the island. Brett goes first.
Go ahead.
Why are there no MP3 players allowed? Like the ones that have no screens?
We want people to unplug. We don't want them to be
tuned out.
That's really important in this whole process.
Wellington adds they don't have enough electricity to keep devices charged. And anyway, no one in the 1800s had MP3 players. But the men aren't buying it.
It's like the whole quitting every substance, all the alcohol, cigarettes, everything at once.
Mm-hmm.
You're just dropping your whole life and coming to the island.
It's the same thing with, like, no TV, no cell phones. Getting to make a phone call, but being told you can only call once every however often. I don't know, that's very difficult for me to just... Same thing with not being able to listen to music, not being able to keep you know, tabs on my favorite football team.
The counselors decide one rule they can relax is supervision. Patients are free to roam the island alone. They can check out a bird sanctuary for Arctic terns on the other side of the island, or visit the leper graveyard from the 1920s. Tracy admits he's already been exploring the shore.
Me, this morning, I was just lost in my own head real quick. That's why
That's fine.
I was starting walking out on the basketball court, and then the next thing I know is I was at the dock. I'm like, oh.
These guys will settle into island life and start to face their demons, Wellington tells me later. It just takes time, something they have here in great supply. For now, they're still getting to know each other, a task made easier by their low-tech entertainment options. For the program to work, the children's study home has some challenges ahead. According to the director, treatment costs $500 per day per client. They're not yet licensed to take insurance, and they don't want it to become a country club clinic for the rich, so right now it's mostly funded by donations. Sadly, they don't expect the demand for opioid treatment to drop off anytime soon. If this approach succeeds, they hope to be a model for the rest of the country, at least wherever there's a free island.
Who's this? Stop showing me up.
For The Pulse, I'm Karen Brown.
Ooh, you mind? All right, at least you got a little underspin there.
Yeah.
You learned that from me.
Karen is a reporter for New England Public Radio. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're talking about the enemy within. When it comes to our health, we have long considered viruses as some of the ultimate enemies. Think HIV, Ebola, or hepatitis. But as scientists continue to explore the human microbiome, they are learning that viruses can be foe or maybe friend.
Viruses don't mean to harm us. It's usually a side effect of their selection for making more of themselves. This is basic Darwinian theory that we want to make more copies, and those that are successful at making more copies dominate the population. Viruses are just like that. If the side effect is causing an epidemic in humans, well, they don't want to be too pathogenic. If you're too pathogenic, you're going to wipe out your host. That's going to be ultimately bad for you.
This is Eric Delwart. He is a laboratory scientist at the Blood Systems Research Institute in San Francisco. I talked to him earlier this week. How many viruses are in my body right now? I'm doing fine today. I'm healthy.
I would eyeball that to be between 5 and 10. And these will be the usual ones that people are maybe familiar with. We have a lot of herpes viruses that, even though that sounds kind of horrible, they usually acquired quite young. They remain latent, and they will not affect you unless you become severely immunosuppressed. You will also have some polyomaviruses. In some cases, some of them in some individual can actually cause cancer or kidney problem or even brain problems. But in most individuals, remain located to the kidney at very low level or the skin, and they will basically chug along without causing any disease. You will also have several anelloviruses. These are very much understudied viruses that everybody has, everybody acquires, probably within weeks of birth from mom or siblings. And these become chronic infections. They can be detected in the blood. As far as we know, they do not cause any disease. You have multiple strains of those from constant reinfection. You have them for life. But because they're generally accepted to be non-pathogenic, they're very little studied.
Are there viruses that perhaps play a beneficial role in our bodies?
So it's been shown that if you raise mice in a totally sterile environment, if you prevent its gut from being colonized with the usual microbiome, which is mostly a sort of a complex mixture of bacteria, they do not develop properly. Their immune system don't develop. Their gut don't develop properly. And of course, you can now introduce a microbiome and help that animal develop, but you can also replace those bacteria by a viral infection, which will help the gut and the immune system develop. So it seems you need some kind of stimulation of the immune system very young to get the whole system rolling and proper development. There may also be beneficial viruses in the sense that they can be oncolytic. They can actually replicate preferentially in tumor cells, and some companies are developing these viruses as therapies for cancers.
So just like a virus might attack my immune system, in this case, that virus would be attacking cancer cells in my body.
Exactly. Viruses in general like to attack or replicate in cells that are dividing. It provides a good milieu for their little machineries to make copies of itself. Just like HIV likes to divide in T cells of the immune system, other viruses prefer certain cancer cells. So what companies are developing are engineered viruses or natural animal viruses that are extremely specific for cancer cells while leaving the rest of the body untouched. And these therapies, which are making good progress in clinical trials, would be the equivalent of a one-shot therapy for cancer.
How fast is this field of study growing? How quickly are we learning more about all the different viruses?
The new revolution in genomics, which is basically the technology allowing us to sequence large quantities of genetic material for human genomes or breeding better animals, is now being applied to viruses and bacteria, and is really transforming the field in the sense that we can now recognize viruses for any virus in any sample for a very low cost. And I can well see the day when people will wake up in the morning, feel a little off, and spit in a cup and have their virome sequenced. That data usually now takes a few days to generate, but with the rapid progress in bioinformatics and the technology of sequencing, there is no reason why the results could not come back in minutes. So now you would know, oh, today I have a rhinovirus infection. Maybe I should not go to work. Maybe I should wash my hands more or not hug my kids so closely. So there's a lot of behavioral change that can come along with more knowledge of what's actually infecting you on any given day.
That's Eric Delwart. He studies viruses at the Blood Systems Research Institute in San Francisco. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. And just like we're learning more about the human microbiome, the vast collection of bacteria, fungi, and viruses that live within us and all over us, researchers are also studying the microbiomes of buildings. Yeah, buildings like your office building and your house. Here's Joan Bennett. She is a fungal geneticist at Rutgers University.
People over the millennia have designed buildings in different ways. We enclose them in different ways. We use different building materials. We bring water into these buildings in various ways. Storms can damage our buildings in various ways. And all of these different parameters can lead to strange changes in the microbial populations within the buildings.
Bennett got interested in the microbiome of buildings back in 2005. She was living in New Orleans at the time, and her house was totally flooded during Hurricane Katrina.
When I went home, I actually sampled my house the way microbiologists do, and I've been studying the molds that were contaminating my own home just about ever since.
She's now leading an ongoing study by the National Academies of Sciences. It's called Microbiomes of the Built Environment. What they are looking for is how these organisms that are present in buildings impact our health. Water is often an enemy, not just during floods.
There's kind of a phrase that people in the building sciences will use flippantly, just add water. And if you add water to what otherwise might be a not very rich habitat for microbes, sort of a microbial desert, it can turn into a microbial jungle, as happened to my home in New Orleans.
Think about your office building or the last hotel you stayed at. The windows didn't open, right? That's true for most modern buildings. And strange things can grow in air vents. There's also the cubicle dwellers. We all shed skin constantly, and we're spreading certain pathogens. And Bennett says a bad mix of these microbes can hurt people. Allergies can get worse. We know about Legionnaire's disease. And then there is a hazy area of something called sick building syndrome, where people just feel unwell.
These disease conditions, which I do believe exist, are fuzzy. We don't entirely understand them. We believe that there is almost certainly an association with microbiology.
So what helps? She says common sense stuff like good airflow, dry conditions, general cleanliness, and get this, just like there's an exploding market of probiotics for people, there are already products out there to improve the microbiome of buildings, and people in the field refer to them as yogurt for buildings. But Bennett says, don't buy them yet.
Those of us who've looked at the field think it's too early to start spraying mixtures of bacteria and fungi into our environments to keep them healthy. But I wouldn't be surprised, after we've learned more, if there will be the development of products like that that are, let's say, less shady than some of the ones that are already on the market.
Joan Bennett is a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and she's leading a National Academies of the Sciences study on the microbiome of built environments.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. If disease and illness is the enemy within us, then physicians and surgeons are the army combating that enemy, an army that needs constant training, a lot of which happens on human cadavers. But a new and growing industry is providing other options. Here's Andrew Stelzer with more.
I'm in the back of a sprawling warehouse in Tampa, Florida, and I feel like I may have just entered the Matrix or some sort of science fiction movie. There are dozens of bodies floating in tubs full of fluid. They've got red and pink muscles, bright blue veins. The sausage-like intestines are spilling out of some of the stomachs. Tara Hayes is struggling to lift one out.
They're very heavy when they're loaded with organs and water. They can get pretty heavy.
Hayes used to be a personal trainer. As she lugs this 6-foot-long human form onto an exam table, she knows what to look for in terms of injuries.
What am I seeing here? Oh, definitely. Well, we've got some algae growing in the intestines. You can see the brown. So we'll replace probably most of those intestines. And we've got updated muscles, like the pecs and the shoulders. We have new ones that we've redesigned, so those will get replaced as well.
If you're starting to get confused, let's clear something up. These are not actual people. They're synthetic bodies produced here at Syndaver Labs. Those replacement parts Hayes is talking about will be made not of human flesh, but of salt, water, and a bunch of meticulously layered, patented fibers. These bodies have been sent back for repairs by universities and other institutions that paid tens of thousands of dollars apiece for these synthetic cadavers. They're used to teach students and test new medical devices. Some of the higher-end models produced by Syndaver, which can run close to $100,000, actually bleed, blink, and have fluctuating body temperatures. But Syndaver CEO Christopher Sakalee says you don't have to buy a whole body. You can purchase anything from a gallbladder to a nipple to a knee.
I think a full intestinal system, something like $900. You can get a stomach for $250. You can buy solid hearts versus chambered hearts, you know, hearts with and without valves, you know, with and without coronaries. So it depends on the level of detail.
Sakalee's came up with the idea to produce synthetic body parts back in grad school. Working on a medical device project, his advisor paid several thousand dollars for a model trachea.
When we got it, it was just pure piece of crap. It was a plastic stick with some spiral rings and a rubber tube in the middle. It was absurd. We got gypped.
Sakalee's thought he could do better, so he made his own trachea, which he says was far superior. Fast forward to today, and Syndaver is a multi-million dollar company doing business with the U.S. military and prestigious medical schools. Syndaver has come pretty close to perfectly recreating a healthy human body, simulating breathing, trauma, and even pupil dilation. That works great to teach anatomy to med students. They're even used in mortuary schools. But recreating imperfect body parts with diseases and abnormalities isn't as easy. I headed up to New Orleans and caught up with someone who's trying a more personalized approach.
Everybody's kidney cancer is a little bit different.
Dr. John Silberstein is chief of urologic oncology at Tulane University School of Medicine.
It's in a different portion of their kidney. It can be bigger, it can be smaller, it can be closer to other important structures or further away from them. And so understanding the individual nature of the patient's disease is going to help the surgeon the most.
A few years ago, Silberstein saw an opportunity coming from two different stakeholders. Surgeons, increasingly trained to operate using robots, might be able to improve outcomes if they saw and felt a kidney in their hands before surgery. He also thought patients could benefit from understanding better what was happening in their bodies. So Silberstein teamed up with Medical Modeling, a 3D printing company now based in Colorado, and asked them to use multiple CAT scans to create lifelike 3D models of his patients' cancerous kidneys.
We were trying to allow the surgeon a dry run, an opportunity to perform the surgery essentially on a model that had all of the characteristics that were identical to their individual patient.
The results are a colorful bunch of kidney-shaped lumps strewn about his small office in downtown New Orleans. Some are red, others are white, while the new ones have several colors to distinguish healthy from unhealthy tissue and connections to other organs.
So this was a different type, and you can feel it. And this one, although it's pretty firm, it's malleable. It folds, it bends, and it's more like sort of the back of an eraser or a really thick gummy bear.
Over the past 3 years, Silberstein's project has printed out about 20 tumorous kidneys. While each is better than the one before, the textures still aren't lifelike enough to perform a realistic mock surgery. But there have already been some benefits. They tested a small group of first-year medical school students who had already worked with cadavers and had some basic training reading scans. After instruction using the 3D-printed kidneys, the students understood the location, size, and risks associated with the tumor much better than they had with a basic radiograph. The kidneys have also been used to prep the cancer patients themselves.
We showed about 10 patients their models before doing surgeries, and patients expressed a much better understanding of the surgery, the surgical technique. They asked much better, more informed questions. And I truly believe that it improves some patient satisfaction.
The dream scenario might look something like this. You walk into the doctor's office, the doctor waves a wand around your midsection. Moments later, a 3D version of your own kidney pops out of a machine. The doc hands it to you, then uses a scalpel to demonstrate the surgery they'd like to do and how your cancer will be removed. With the passion of people like Dr. Silberstein and the technology produced by companies like Syndaver, that hands-on medical experience may come sooner than we think. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
We've been talking about the enemy within on today's show. We started the hour talking to people who have come to terms with adversity in their lives, different painful conditions they are living with. And our final story is about a man who turned his adversity into his trademark. Mace Buggin was born with a serious disability during the Great Depression. His parents were immigrants, and the odds were stacked against him. But he became a successful realtor, a businessman. He was flipping houses long before that was a thing. And he was also obsessed with meeting celebrities. His great-niece, Gabrielle Kaplan-Meyer, shared her memories of her beloved relative, and she also brought in some cassette tapes. Mace often had a recorder with him and just liked to keep kind of an audio diary.
This is my great uncle, Mace Buggin, who was my grandmother's younger brother.
I was born in Phillipsburg, New Jersey, on June the 12th, 1915. I was raised in a Jewish home.
And it was clear when Mace was just an infant that his skeleton, his spine looked different from her, you know, my great-grandmother's other babies, and soon a specialist diagnosed him as a dwarf. He grew to be 43 inches tall. He was the person in the room who lit up the room, who set a tone of cheerfulness, and he was very grateful for what he had.
At the age of 19, I graduated from Phillipsburg High School.
He went on a bus by himself from Phillipsburg, New Jersey to Chicago, if you can imagine this. He wanted to go to Chicago because it was boxer Joe Louis's first professional fight, and he was following him. And he loved boxing, and he wanted to be there. He made it through the crowd and down to the front. And because he was small, he often said he would go right through people's legs.
218. Joe Louis.
He jumped into the ring. The Lewis and the other fighter were in there. He went up. He kissed Joe Lewis's gloves. And it was caught on a newsreel, on the RKO newsreel. And that was how people got their news at that time. And so this was seen all over the world. And he became an instant celebrity.
By the way, the action in the ring right now, as you see, is the midget who has come into the ring. And he's in there.
It gave him such a sense of self-esteem that he did. Whenever he went to a sporting event, whenever he went to a Broadway show, whenever he went to a concert, he made sure that he got to meet his favorite athletes or performers and get his photos taken.
My name happens to be in a few books.
He liked the attention. He liked being a celebrity. He felt like he was able to do something that other people weren't able to do.
I have been interviewed by the press, newspapers, magazines, many times.
He was known for these antics of getting in the gate, jumping in the ring, and the gossip columnist Walter Winchell wrote about him in his column in the mid-50s and called him the little gate crasher. He would hurry out back. He would, you know, sort of charm the bodyguard, whoever was there, and he got his photo.
We went down to see Walt Frazier play, and we couldn't get in the dressing room. We had my wheelchair. Walt Frazier walked by. He was going in the toilet. He had his shorts on, the jock strap. And he says, "Hey, I know that little guy. Let him in."
Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, of course, Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, Ella Fitzgerald, Jackie Mason. Another one of my favorite photos in the book is Mace shaking Richard Nixon's hand. And this was so amazing because he went under the security ropes. It's really something that you couldn't imagine happening today. And a startled Nixon turns around and also makes this deep eye contact with Mace, and they share their moment. In every way, he was an unstoppable spirit. His energy, his charisma, his willingness to live life on his own terms and to live a good life. I think he was always conscious of the fact that wherever he was, people were going to look at him. And I think the celebrity photos were his way of flipping that around and saying, if you're going to look at me, look at this. You don't have a photo with Muhammad Ali. And make people look at him differently.
Gabrielle Kaplan-Meyer has written a book about her great uncle Mace Buguin. It's called The Little Gate Crasher. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer. Joel Patterson is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, when is the best time to tell your dentist that you are in recovery from addiction? Well, definitely not when you're sitting in the chair with your mouth full of cotton balls.
You're not really in a state of mind to be like, "Oh, hey, by the way, I have a problem with opiates, so make sure you don't give me any drugs."
Dentists, opioids, and addiction. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.